the section of the book which deals with the various voices, if you will, of the manifestation of God. How from in different periods during their ministry they speak with the accents of different degrees or stations, all of which are present in their inner reality. This has been one of the sources of confusion to the believers in past religions. For instance, we had Christ, someone addressing Christ saying, "Good Master," and he said, he told them, there's no good master but God who is in heaven. And then on another occasion he would say that I and the Father are one, and whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So then you would understand that he was saying that he was God. And these diverse expressions on the part of the manifestation led to divisions in schools of understanding of their faiths. In fact, became major doctrinal points, as you can appreciate from the history of Christianity. The great councils were called to discuss what indeed was the station of Christ. And finally out of that came the Trinity and the beliefs that there were three things. There was God the Father, God the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Now, as you know from your studies of some answered questions and the talks of Abdu'l-Bahá, and of course the Quran itself, the manifestation of God has a threefold reality. One is his individual physical being, which is made up of atoms the same as yours, your body, and my body. Baha'u'llah in one tablet says that the only difference is that because of the connection with the manifestation, these atoms are as if they were in the station of diamonds. That is, within their own level, they are charged, so to speak, with the reality of the manifestation of God. But they're still atoms, and the physical dust of the manifestation of God is still physical dust. Although there is this mysterious lingering of some power or presence at the shrines, which Shoghi Effendi mentions in some of his letters, which impresses us, and whatever is ordained by God as a holy place, a holy house, has its influence also in the world. And in a tablet, Baha'u'llah says, this is not because that place has more endowments than other places, but because it's been chosen by God for a purpose that it has this effect. And if God removes that purpose from it, then that effect is removed also. Now, we have the second stage of reality of the manifestation of God, which Abdu'l-Bahá explains as the soul of the manifestation, that is his individual reality, which is this first station, if you will, that actually becomes the second station here in this explanation of the Quran, where there is a separateness between the manifestations of God. Each one comes in a distinct time, each one is the bearer of a distinct mission, has a separate title, lends a different emphasis to the revelation of God, has their own individual lifespan, has their own name, their own family, so to speak. So all these things characterize the individuality of the manifestation of God, but his soul also, he says, is a human soul. That is, it is not divine in itself. Although the quality of it is such that it sheds light rather than reflects light. So it functions slightly different from ours. And what is the one other difference? I mean, one other difference that you can remember from the writings. I'm sure there's an infinite range of differences, but one other difference that you can remember from the writings between the soul, the individual human soul, and the soul of the manifestation? That the soul of the manifestation is pre-existent. That it has existed in the worlds of God in a manner which we cannot depict or understand before its coming with its particular mission into the body of a human being and living in this world. But it's not that same soul that comes back again in another manifestation of God. Each one of the manifestations has its own individual reality. The part of them that's identical is this divine effulgence, this bounty of God, this divine sun of truth, which shines through their souls, and which is synonymous with the world of command, or the world of the prophets, as it's sometimes called. Although it's not the world the prophets live in, it's the world of the prophetic reality, the world of command in the ringstone symbol, the middle of the three conditions of existence, a condition which surrounds and permeates the station of creation, upon which it shines with all of its splendor. The individual realities of the manifestations of God remain as dwellers in that created kingdom. Though they are still the vehicles of this divine truth, they have their individual expression in the world to come. And we read in tablets that where we invoke prayers that we might be associated with the prophets of God, the messengers of God, and His chosen ones in the worlds to come. And Baha'u'llah promises that those souls who have been faithful to God will attain the presence of the messengers of God in the next world, and will openly converse with them, and will recount to them that which they have suffered or what has befallen them in the path of God. I think you've heard me mention before, if we have nothing that we've suffered in the path of God, it's going to be a short conversation. But if we have had a lifetime of service and sacrifice and so on, we will have something with which to recount. Now, obviously, we may be speechless besides that, just in the nature of things. But I don't know how the communications take place in the next world. Whatever we have, of course, of suffering is nothing compared to what the manifestations of God have themselves submitted to. And maybe they submit themselves to all this so that the believers aren't in a position of having suffered more than they have for the sake of God, you know, because we're told they have the power to overcome creation at any moment, but they submit and they let the drama of the way people react to their mission and to the declaration of their truths to be acted out, this drama that takes place around them, the opposition, the fierce opposition, the return of those who we've read here arise and oppose the purpose of God in each age when the manifestations appear. On page 176, we have already in the foregoing pages, to review a little, assigned two stations under each of the luminaries arising from the day springs of eternal holiness. One of these stations, the station of essential unity, we've already explained. And this is the station of the world of command, the divine primal will, the word of God that appears in each of the manifestations of God and is one universal, all-comprehensive reality. It is also a knowledge that they all bear together. In this sense, no distinction do we make between any of them. The other is the station of distinction, and pertaineth to the world of creation and to the limitations thereof. In this respect, each manifestation of God hath a distinct individuality, a definitely prescribed mission, a predestined revelation, and specially designated limitations. Each one of them is known by a different name, is characterized by a special attribute, fulfills a definite mission, and is entrusted with a particular revelation. Even as he said, some of the apostles we have caused to excel the others. To some God has spoken, some he hath raised and exalted. To Jesus, son of Mary, we gave manifest signs, and we strengthened him with the Holy Spirit. He confirms his argument with a reference from the Quran here. It is because of this difference in their station and mission that the words and utterances flowing from these wellsprings of divine knowledge appear to diverge and differ. Otherwise, in the eyes of them that are initiated into the mysteries of divine wisdom, All their utterances are in reality but the expressions of one truth. This phrase a couple times in the writings. It's initiated in the mysteries, into the mysteries of divine wisdom. I don't know who those people are, but certainly this reveals to us that such a position exists. And in a sense, the fact that the Guardian has chosen the word initiated to translate this verse is very significant. We are, by degrees, initiated into divine understanding. It is the choice of God that we understand. It is somewhat dependent on making ourselves receptive. But the understanding itself is something that flows from Him, if you will. As we have seen confirmed earlier in the book, knowledge is a light that we shineth, that God shineth in the heart of whomsoever He willeth. So this knowledge, this understanding is something that flows from Him. If you turn away from it, your understanding of it goes away again. If your sight turns down to lower things, these truths that you were once aware of, you may be able to verbally sketch them, but do you comprehend them? Do you partake and participate in their reality, in the dimension of truth that they contain? And this is the point of polishing the heart and improving our perception, if you will, of divine truths, making ourselves ready so that whatever favors God pours upon us, we will be sensitive to them. So he says, otherwise in the eyes of them that are initiated into the mysteries of divine wisdom, all their utterances are in reality but the expressions of one truth. As most of the people have failed to appreciate those stations to which we have referred, they therefore feel perplexed and dismayed at the varying utterances pronounced by manifestations that are essentially one and the same. It hath ever been evident that all these divergences of utterance are attributable to differences of station, thus viewed from the standpoint of their oneness and sublime detachment. The attributes of Godhead, divinity, supreme singleness, and inmost essence have been and are applicable to those essences of being, inasmuch as they all abide on the throne of divine revelation and are established upon the seat of divine concealment. Through their appearance, the revelation of God is made manifest, and by their countenance, the beauty of God is revealed. Thus it is that the accents of God Himself have been heard uttered by these manifestations of the divine being. Viewed in the light of their second station, the station of distinction, differentiation, temporal limitations, characteristics, and standards, they manifest absolute servitude, utter destitution, and complete self-effacement. Even as he hath said, I am the servant of God, I am but a man like you. From these incontrovertible and fully demonstrated statements, strive thou to apprehend the meaning of the questions thou hast asked, that thou mayest become steadfast in the faith of God and not be dismayed by the divergences in the utterances of his prophets and chosen ones. Now he goes on to describe some of these stations. He says, were any of the all-embracing manifestations of God to declare, I am God, he verily speaketh the truth, and no doubt attacheth thereto, for it hath been repeatedly demonstrated that through their revelation, their attributes and names, the revelation of God, His name and His attributes are made manifest in the world. Thus He hath revealed, those shafts were God's, not thine. And also He saith, in truth they who plighted fealty unto thee really plighted that fealty unto God. And were any of them to voice the utterance, and here comes to a second stage now, I am the messenger of God, he also speaketh the truth, the indubitable truth. Even as he saith, Muhammad is not the father of any man among you, but he is the messenger of God. Viewed in this light, they are all but messengers of that ideal king, that unchangeable essence. And were they all to proclaim, I am the seal of the prophets, they verily utter but the truth, beyond the faintest shadow of doubt. For they are all but one person, one soul, one spirit, one being, one revelation. They are all the manifestation of the beginning and the end, the first and the last, the seen and the hidden. all of which pertain to him who is the innermost spirit of spirits and the eternal essence of essences. And were they to say, we are the servants of God, this also is a manifest and indisputable fact. For they have been made manifest in the uttermost state of servitude, a servitude the like of which no man can possibly attain. Thus, in moments in which these essences of being were deeply immersed beneath the oceans of ancient and everlasting holiness, and when they soared to the loftiest summits of divine mysteries, they claimed their utterance to be the voice of divinity, the call of God himself. Were the eye of discernment to be opened, it would recognize that in this very state they have considered themselves utterly effaced and non-existent in the face of him who is the all-pervading, the incorruptible. Methinks they have regarded themselves as utter nothingness and deemed their mention in that court an act of blasphemy. For the slightest whisperings of self within such a court is an evidence of self-assertion and independent existence. In the eyes of them that have attained unto that court, such a suggestion is itself a grievous transgression. How much more grievous would it be were aught else to be mentioned in that presence, were man's heart, his tongue, his mind, or his soul to be busied with anyone but the well-beloved, were his eyes to behold any countenance other than his beauty, were his ear to be inclined to any melody but his voice, and were his feet to tread any way but his way. In this day, the breeze of God, this is one of these small punctuations that Baha'u'llah puts in the book we've talked about previously, you know, like the universe is pregnant and so on. In this day, the breeze of God is wafted, and his spirit hath pervaded all things. Such is the outpouring of his grace that the pen is stilled and the tongue is speechless. There is no holy book which has revealed these kinds of mysteries in the past that we have any record of, just even these last two pages that we've read. How can we understand the divinity of the manifestation of God? He's told us here. There is an essence beyond the manifestation of God, but if the manifestation chooses to speak in the first person and says, I am God, he says, this is the truth. This is the voice of God speaking through him. Not that God himself or the exalted essence has a tongue, but he has the tongue of the manifestation and he speaks with it. He uses it. He's completely submissive, immersed, self-effaced, until what's left is the presence of God acting through him. Though that is not the only expression of God, as we know there's going to be revelations of even Baha'u'llah's magnitude in other planets, in other realms, in other worlds, both physical and spiritual. On an infinite scale, the Master affirms this in one of his tablets. No way to number the manifestations of God that appear to the creatures, to endless, numberless creatures, in endless, numberless planets and worlds beyond this one. Now, how the essence of God is going to limit himself to one human being, one human body in one of these planets, begins to become ludicrous to us when you think of it in that scale. And yet, it's not the magnitude of the size, but the greatness of these primary mirrors of the light of God amongst human souls. That's the greatness of Baha'u'llah. That he mirrors that light in its pure, undiluted essence. And if you see, Abdu'l-Baha says, the sun shining in a crystal mirror, have you not seen the sun? Yet you must remember that that's not the sun. It's a reflection of the sun. And yet it is the sun in another sense, because it's reflected in its full splendor in that crystal mirror that you see nothing of the mirror. All you see is the reflection of the sun from its ancient hidden identity. It's shining out of this mirror. But we always must remember that the innermost essence, the essence, the spirit of spirits, is a separate reality from the manifestations of God. Even though they are its embodiment, if you will, its reflection, and all these titles and names refer to it, still that essence is exalted in its own sanctity and oneness, completely separate from anything that is its creation. And he tells us that the manifestations themselves are confounded when they try to dwell or think back to that level of reality. Sometimes the Baha'is might get confused because you read here, he says, "Verily, verily, I am God," and we say, "Well, Baha'u'llah is God, what's the difference? I mean, for me he's God and that's it." And there's a tablet of Baha'u'llah to one of the believers who had was saying things like this. And he said that sometimes the believers behold the essence of God in the person of the manifestation. They bear witness that they see God in him. Others say that they see in the manifestation the revelation of the laws and attributes and power of God in that sense, but that they see it as separate. But then he says both are right. But should one believer argue with another believer on this subject, both are wrong and rejected in my presence. So we have a right to some latitude of expression, but we should be sure that the limits of that latitude of understanding are circumscribed by the authorized interpretations of Shoghi Effendi and Abdul Baha, and not our own idea of what Baha'u'llah is saying. For instance, Shoghi Effendi says he's never to be identified with that essence of essences. Any of the manifestations, even the exalted divinity of Baha'u'llah himself, he says, can't be identified with that. He's always to be distinguished from. And that's the... However we understand the divinity of Baha'u'llah, we should realize that it is a reflection. It is a mirrored image. If we do that, we can glorify his being and his godhood and his God sense and everything else that he brings. And I wonder if we won't do that more. This is a kind of a test, I think, to some of the believers and some of the, certainly the seekers in the faith, when they see these very strong statements from Baha'u'llah. "Verily, verily, I am God and there is no God but me. From all eternity I have been the essence and sovereign Lord of all things." And you read these things in his writings, you wonder how it is somebody has said this. And yet at the same time, I think that the fact that we are now the children of the day of God, if you will, that gradually as the majority of the people come to the faith, they will rejoice in the fact that this they are part of the dispensation in which God has spoken so often in the first person through the manifestation of God. This is a special bounty that we have if we say this is the day of God himself. You know? There's a hadith, I understand, in Islam, which says that in the last day God will come twice. Once he'll come and he'll call himself God, but it will be too much for the people. Then he will come again and he will call himself the servant of God. Curious tradition. Yes. Let's see if I have the source on that. First of all, on that page there's a reference number 3, Quran 33:40, which it says after we are the servants of God, remove that and move it up to the line, "He is the messenger of God." That's a reference to the previous quotation up in the first third, "Muhammad is not the father of any man among you." That's the Quran 33:40. This is a typographical mistake here. Now, "I am but a man like you" is the one you're looking at?
And the sentence of God.
Yes. That's a compounded verse. It's from two verses of the Quran. The first half of it is Surah 19, verse 31. And the second half of it is Surah 18, verse 110. Look at those. You're not going to find them unless you look them up yourselves until a new edition of the Iqan comes out. The verse, "I am the servant of God," is from the Quran, Surah 19, verse 31.
Excuse me, what
That's the previous page. It's about from where Muhammad is not the father of any man. It's about two paragraphs before that, at the end of a paragraph which begins. That's it, yes.
Okay, and that's from the Quran what?
That's from the Quran, Surah 19, verse 31. And the second half, I am but a man like you, Surah 18, verse 110. Are they? You're there? They're fixed there? Oh, good. I've got the older edition stuff. Glad they caught up with it. Now, with regard to I am God, did I read this last week to you, Alise? I don't know. Did I read to you from the epistle last week on I am God? Don't think we got to that yet. Anyway, if you don't remember, we'll read it again. Divinity, whenever I mention it, Baha'u'llah says there, and he's addressing the objections of the son of the wolf, indicateth my complete and absolute self-effacement. This is the station in which I have no control over mine own will or woe, nor over my life, nor over my resurrection. So we have this double image about the self-effacement being the essence of this divinity, complete and utter self-effacement. This is why at times Baha'u'llah says, I am God. The voice of God is saying, I am God, if you will. Using him, speaking through him, and he's simply indicating in that the total effacement of his own self in the midst of that operation. When I contemplate God, when I contemplate, O my God, the relationship that bindeth me to thee, Baha'u'llah says in another tablet, I am moved to proclaim to all created things, verily I am God. But when I consider my own self, lo, I find it coarser than clay. And Shoghi Effendi affirming this truth that we've mentioned earlier, that Baha'u'llah should, notwithstanding the overwhelming intensity of his revelation, be regarded as essentially one of these manifestations of God, never to be identified with that invisible reality, the essence of divinity itself, is one of the major beliefs of our faith. A belief which should never be obscured, and the integrity of which no one of its followers should allow to be compromised. So you have a certain responsibility to see these things this way. That's from the World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 114, that particular affirmation. It's one of the central truths of the revelation expounded by Shoghi Effendi in the dispensation, the letter of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah. Now, if we go back to the text, by virtue of this station, they have claimed for themselves the voice of divinity and the like, whilst by virtue of their station of messengership, they have declared themselves the messengers of God. In every instance, they have voiced an utterance that would conform to the requirements of the occasion, and have ascribed all these declarations to themselves. Declarations ranging from the realm of divine revelation to the realm of creation, and from the domain of divinity even unto the domain of earthly existence. Thus it is that whatsoever be their utterance, whether it pertain to the realm of divinity, lordship, prophethood, messengership, guardianship, apostleship, or servitude, all is true beyond the shadow of a doubt. So we have seven stations he's defined there for these utterances of the manifestation of God. If you're following some of the Persian friends here, this is again, this divine realm of divine revelation is Amr, and the realm of creation is Khalq. Amr and Khalq, these two contrasting positions. And the domain of divinity is Rububiyyah, and earthly existence is Mulkiyyah. And the divinity itself, I can't read my own writing, Uluhiyat, I think it is, Uluhiyat, huh? And then Rububiyyah, or Rububiyat, Nubuiyat, Rasulat, Valiat, Imamat, and Ubudiyat. These are the seven stages in the original. Therefore, these sayings which we have quoted in support of our argument must be attentively considered, that the divergent utterances of the manifestations of the unseen and daysprings of holiness may cease to agitate the soul and perplex the mind. Now, with this key, one can rejoice in it all rather than being confounded and confused. These words, uttered by the luminaries of truth, must needs be pondered, and should their significance not be grasped, enlightenment should be sought from the trustees of the depositories of knowledge. Now, we've got a few notes here. In this day, the breeze of God is wafted. Consider how Baha'u'llah repeatedly punctuates the Agan with these powerful expressions of the greatness of his own dawning revelation. Concerning the divine breezes, he later reveals, no breeze can compare with the breezes of divine revelation. Whilst the word which is uttered by God shineth and flasheth as the sun amidst the books of men. Happy the man that hath discovered it and recognized it, and said, praise be thou who art the desire of the world, and thanks be to thee, O well-beloved of the hearts of such as are devoted to thee. That's from the Epistle of the Son of the Wolf, page 42. The guardian was asked about guardianship in this list. Naturally, with he being a guardian, it says that one of the levels of utterance is guardianship. And some of the believers were saying, ah, then the guardian is really the manifestation of God, but he's just come in the form of a guardian. So they asked him about this. And he said, is there any reference to Abdu'l-Bahá or to the institution of the guardianship in the following quotation? And then they said, Thus it is that whatsoever be their utterance, whether it pertain to the realm of this and this and this, and mentions guardianship, all is true. Also, are any manifestations to whom the titles of servitude have been particular, to whom the title of servitude, the titles of servitude have been particularly applied? The guardian answered through his secretary, says, the passage you have quoted from the Agan refers to the prophets only, and not to the guardianship. All divine manifestations have a station of servitude, and the latter does not apply to one or some of them to the exclusion of the rest. So in that sense, we could also understand that all the messengers have the station of divinity as well, and could express themselves from that level. Please. That's the next note. Shoghi Effendi answers your question. He says, we cannot be sure to whom Baha'u'llah refers as the trustees of knowledge. So if he doesn't know, let's not ask each other.
About the first one, the other level of utterance, servitude, then when Abdu'l-Bahá shows the title of servant of Baha'u'llah, some of it comes with it.
I don't suppose they link the two together, but maybe they have. I haven't never heard that they have. They never said he was claiming the station of servitude. They said he was claiming the station of prophethood. And then his servitude was not to God, but to Baha'u'llah. So whereas the prophet servitude, of course, is to God the essence. So I suppose that's be the difference. Might be the difference. Trustees of the depositories of knowledge. We don't know, what does it say? We cannot be sure to whom Baha'u'llah refers as the trustees of knowledge. Sounds like Shoghi Effendi's humility too, doesn't it? At the same time, I mean, we know that the knowledge of interpretation has been vested in Abdu'l Baha and Shoghi Effendi, but he doesn't link it necessarily with this expression here. In fact, he doesn't link it. For it behooveth no man that these may expound their meaning and unravel their mystery. For it behooveth no man to interpret the holy words according to his own imperfect understanding, nor having found them to be contrary to his inclinations and desires, to reject and repudiate their truth. Ask them, I don't know. I don't think so. Now, what is the phrase? There's another phrase, I think it's quoted here someplace too. The repositories of knowledge, something like that in another spot here. Do somebody remember that? It's not too far away. It seems
on one of the previous pages, it was those who are initiated in the mysteries of divine wisdom, those who are.
Yes, that's one, but there's a quote from the Quran which talks about, you know, you should consult the manifestations and the messenger, or they who are endowed with knowledge, or something, they who have attained it, or repositories of knowledge. Something quite rather similar to this, which have been, that verse of the Quran has been interpreted by the Bab as referring to the holy imams. But then that was the Quranic expression of it. Now we have the Baha'i expression of it here. Shoghi Effendi says we can't be sure who he refers to. Obviously, when Shoghi Effendi, when Baha'u'llah is mentioning this, he certainly doesn't mean turn back to the imams. At this, by the time he's using it in his own words, I shouldn't imagine he's referring to turning back to the imams for illumination, because it says these words must be pondered, and should their significance not be grasped, enlightenment should be sought from the trustees of the depositories of knowledge, that they may expound their meaning and unravel their mystery. Now, we've never seen anything that the house is expounds mysteries or unravels, expounds meanings or unravels mysteries. To the contrary, you know, it can resolve difficulties, misunderstandings which have arisen amongst the believers over some point in the text which is not clear. But beyond that, as far as elucidating meanings and going on and on, the house doesn't engage in that, to my understanding. We can't go into all of this. There's something about learning here. On page 184, we have knowledge is one point which the foolish have multiplied. Again, knowledge is a light which God sheddeth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth. He repeats here. Knowledge is one point is a saying attributed to the Imam Ali. Knowledge is a light is a tradition attributed to Muhammad. Knowledge is all that is knowable is a tradition attributed to the Imam Sadiq. Knowledge is one point comes from Ali, the Imam Ali. Knowledge is a light that God sheddeth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth is from Muhammad. Knowledge is all that is knowable, that's on the next page, 185. And might and power all creation. This is from the Imam Sadiq, one of the 12 Imams.
making a few corrections here while we go along. The next time I print this, it'll be in better order. Sorry. For instance, a certain man, and here there's a cross-reference to Haji Mirza Karim Khan. Haji Mirza Karim Khan was one of the self-proclaimed Shaykhi leaders after Sayyid Kazim. He is the author of numerous books, including a vicious attack on the Bab, written at the request of Nasruddin Shah. You can find a little more about him, that particular point, in God Passes By, page 91. Baha'u'llah refers to his works here. We already had some mention of this when we were discussing alchemy. You have either read this for yourself or you can read it. We want to move on beyond this to come to the section on the true seeker. Let's see, there are a few interim notes. Page 186. But for thee, at the top of the page, but for thee I would not have created the spheres. This is a tradition said to have been revealed to the Imam Ali again. The Miraj, the mystery of the Miraj. The Miraj is the ascent. It is used with reference to Muhammad's celestial vision or his night journey through the seven heavens. So it's ascent in the sense of the night journey of Muhammad through the seven heavens, which is one of the visions that Muhammad had and he describes in the Quran. Well, there's various traditions that point in different directions. Sometimes the scheme of things is ad intra and sometimes ad extra. In other words, sometimes divinity is at the center of seven spheres and sometimes it's the all surrounding force, so that the middle one is the earth and then the other heavens are surrounding it in degrees. You remember we saw earlier that Christ ascended to the fourth heaven. That was in the old scheme of the crystalline heavens, that the heavens were made out of crystals, one inside the other, that moved. The sun was said to be fixed in the fourth heaven rather than in some other outside of that realm. The point is that in the night journey, Muhammad describes them as seven spiritual heavens rather than the outer heavens, rather than the seven spheres of the early scientists. And these seven heavens he talks about passing through and seeing a prophet seated on a throne in the center of each of those heavens, around which revolved all the beings in that particular realm. Then he would ascend to a higher heaven and so on. He names the prophets that are on them until he came to the seventh heaven, in which he heard the voice of the glory of God speaking to him from out of the Sadratul Muntaha, the tree beyond which there is no passing, which is this highest station, if you will, of the manifestation of God. And that's made reference to, of course, we've seen in various places in the writings, the Sadratul Muntaha, even in the Quran itself. It is the furthermost tree, and it's symbolic of the tree that Muhammad saw in the highest heaven, and from which he heard this voice and saw the light of the glory of God shining from behind 10,000 veils. Something of the sort. Further down on page 186, flingest thou thy calumnies under the face of them whom the one true God hath made the trustees of the treasures of his seventh sphere? This is a verse from the Masnavi of Rumi. And again, on the next page, all human attainment moveth upon a lame ass, whilst truth, riding upon the wind, darteth across space. This is also from the Masnavi of Rumi. Rumi is an amazing station. You know, here's a man who was not a prophet, but who had a book. Abdu'l-Bahá plays on this a little bit in his tablets. He says that There's tradition in poetry that there are some prophets who don't have a book, and there are some books that don't have a prophet. And this book of the Masnavi of Rumi is one of those divine books that has such an influence. And even we find here in the, amongst the family, and when they were out in the countryside in different occasions, Baha'u'llah would call for them to chant the Masnavi of Rumi. He himself enjoyed it. He cites it in his writings. He takes time to write tablets interpreting the verses of the Masnavi. What are the divine significances of these verses? Abdu Baha also. I wonder how the soul of Rumi felt in the other realm when he saw the Supreme Manifestation is telling the meanings that maybe he didn't even know were in those verses, I don't know. And if I recall correctly, I haven't seen the text, but I've heard this explained from the Persians. They say that the two poles of Muhammad on one end and in maintaining the spiritual tone of the age and getting us on to the time when the Bab would appear. His Masnavi has been rendered into English by Nicholson with very copious notes and explanations. It's available through Luzak in London. So that they have the Persian volumes, and then they have the translation volumes, and then they have volumes of notes, all things about like that. But recently, within the last decade or so, it's been published in paperback as well. And it's not that much cheaper in paperback, but it's a lot cheaper than it was in hardback in the old days. You can probably see a copy of it here at our library. If you don't all go at once, then send me an email of some sort. It's very interesting to look at, and it's filled with magical stories, beautiful stories about the prophets and about spiritual realities and things. On page 190, Baha'u'llah speaks about, "But of what avail all this generation could offer us were wounds from its darts. And the only cup it proffered to our lips was the cup of its venom. On our neck we still bear the scar of chains, and upon our body are imprinted the evidences of an unyielding cruelty." As you'll recall, Baha'u'llah was imprisoned in the Sayyid Shal for 4 months in 1852. During this period, while his neck was weighed down by a mighty chain, to quote God Passes By, he received the intimation of his prophetic mission. Scars from the galling weight of these chains remained with him the rest of his days and remained on his body. See God Passes By, page 101, if you want a historical cross-reference to that particular point. Without getting into the details again of Haji Mirza Karim Khan and the fruit of the infernal tree which he's eating of and so on. On the next page, 191, he says, "They have rejected the Moses of knowledge and justice and clung to the Samiri." Samiri, is that right in your edition? Samiri. There's an accent on the A and the last I to make them long vowels. Mine isn't, it's all short vowels. This edition. Now, who is this Samiri? A magician contemporary with Moses. We go farther than that. He was the magician who tempted the Israelites to the worship of the golden calf while Moses was on the mountain. Later, after this violation, he became an outcast wanderer. for Outcast Wanderer, you might read Covenant Breaker. The reference to this is in the Quran, verse 20 of Surah 20, verse 85. 2085. Now we turn the page and we enter into the perhaps most celebrated passage of the Kitab-i Ghan, the admonitions about the true seeker, sometimes called, quite erroneously and without any basis, the tablet of the true seeker. There is no such thing as the tablet of the true seeker, it's a passage from the Ghan. But it gets called that by various and sundry. I hope you don't ever catch me doing it, but that may happen too. I find as I get older, the brain does funny things. Now, maybe Anderson will come. You'll have another voice to hear and read us this first paragraph. I just want to read it complete. It's so beautiful to listen to.
My brother, when a true seeker determines to take the step of search in the path leading to the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, he must, before all else, cleanse and purify his heart, which is the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God, from the obscuring dust of all acquired knowledge and the illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy. He must purge his breast, which is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the beloved, of every defilement, and sanctify his soul from all that pertaineth to water and clay, from all shadowy and ephemeral attachments. He must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein, lest that love blindly incline him to error, or that hate repel him away from the truth. Even as thou dost witness in this day, how most of the people, because of such love and hate, are bereft of the immortal face, have strayed far from the embodiments of the divine mysteries, and shepherdless are roaming through the wilderness of oblivion and error. That seeker must at all times put his trust in God, must renounce the peoples of the earth, detach himself from the world of dust, and cleave unto him who is the Lord of Lords. He must never seek to exalt himself above anyone, must wash away from the tablet of his heart every trace of pride and vainglory, must cling unto patience and resignation, observe silence, and refrain from idle talk. For the tongue is a smoldering fire, and excess of speech a deadly poison. Material fire consumeth the body, whereas the fire of the tongue devoureth both heart and soul. The force of the former lasteth but for a time, whilst the effects of the latter endure a century.
Here again we have the reference to the heart being the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God. In one of Shoghi Effendi's letters, he says it's the repository of the ancient mysteries of God, the human soul. Now, it may be obscured with layers of dust and other acquired learning and so on, but these priceless gems God has placed within the soul of all peoples. And if we could but lift the veils, we would see these lights in the center of our beings. He says here that before all else, the seeker must cleanse and purify his heart, which is the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God, from the obscuring dust of all acquired knowledge and the illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy. Now, we had the two kinds of knowledge earlier on. One of them is satanic fancy. One of them is satanic knowledge. That is knowledge that derives from the interests of self, of fame, of fortune, of whatever is of this world, and not this essence of spiritual knowledge that the soul should seek. And he calls this obscuring dust. You don't see the inner mysteries of God because we don't see, because our eyes are filled with this dust, if you will. Our heart is overshadowed with this dust. We've spoken before, you're aware of the theme in the writings, that we must free ourselves, detach ourselves from the views of our nation, our race, the time we live in, our families, so many different things that have been, in modern language, programmed into us, if you will, through which we see things, that we have to purge out of ourselves if we're to get any kind of clear vision of the immensity and greatness of the cause. In other words, we've always been taught that religion is a certain something. And even our view of the Baha'i Faith, we have our view of the Baha'i Faith. That is not the Baha'i Faith, that's our view of the Baha'i Faith. We're like iconoclasts, we have to constantly crack the image we have of the faith and create a new one in its stead. As our vision extends and becomes greater, we've got to eliminate the limited, petty way we relate to our religion and our faith, and begin seeing it more in terms of the divine verses, in terms of those very verses which Shoghi Effendi has placed at the end of the advent of divine justice for daily meditation, says, which have such overpowering effect on the soul and on the soul's development. This is a day that the like of which has never been witnessed. We cannot compare it with our inherited way of viewing life, and certainly we cannot look at it correctly through the lenses of a materialistic, indulgent civilization which is surrounding us and which we've been seeped in, if you will, from early childhood. Not even our devoted parents have been able to convey to us images free from these constrictions. Maybe to some degree they have, but still they're fighting the same battle. And we're all moving through it, and of course it's by degrees. Now, in the teaching work, there's this wonderful divine power that comes to us in teaching and speaking of the faith, that he promises us when we open our lips to proclaim the faith, we will be inspired. Even Abdu'l-Bahá in some of his tablets mentions that it is improper to prepare to give a talk. I mean, if you decide what you're going to say ahead of time, how, when you're at the moment you're going to speak, you want to turn to the kingdom and ask that God confirm you to say that which should be said on that occasion, instead of, well, I already have my talk prepared. That'll, you know, just upset my program. So, okay, maybe he said this to special teachers at special times. Let us allow for that. But be ready, in case you get carried away with inspiration, that you will flow with it, that you'll let it happen, because it's promised to be there. Now, I know Rahil Khanum, she says whenever she's going to do a public talk, she's scared to death, and she makes notes, outlines a whole talk, and she has it there in her purse or somewhere, and she never refers to it, and she never gives that talk, she said. But she has it there in case the inspiration somehow is not there at the moment you need it. And I do the same kind of thing, I'm sure, that a lot of the friends do that, just to have something to fall back on in case you're left standing on the platform all by yourself. There's a story about Mirza Abul Fazl when he was traveling in America. At one stage, he was before an audience, a university audience. I don't know how many, hundreds of people. And he thought to himself, Mirza Abul Fazl, look where you've come and what you're doing here. And he said that at that moment, his mind went blank. He couldn't say anything. And he was standing there in front of these people waiting. They were supposed to start to talk, and he couldn't speak. So he started reflecting on what... Then he reflected on what he just thought, and how he had his presumption that he was here because of anything of himself. And he began to beg forgiveness in his heart to God right at the spot. Then the inspiration came back, and he went and he gave a nice talk. And but he makes mention of this... episode. So it's always good to have something to fall back on, but actually invoking the name of Baha'u'llah at the moment, I think, is probably the best way out of some kind of speechlessness. The illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy, that's the same people that are around us all the time, and probably some of the popular authors we're reading in our daily... articles in magazines and newspapers and so on. I mean, I don't think we should think of these as some mystical beings off on the horizon. They're you and me talking to each other, you know. He must purge his breast, which is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the beloved, of every defilement, and sanctify his soul from all that pertaineth to water and clay, and from all shadowy and ephemeral attachments. So here you have a cleansing of knowledge, and then you have a cleansing of affection as well. On one hand, the knowledge, on the other hand, the love. He must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein, lest that love blindly incline him to error, or that hate repel him away from the truth. Even as thou dost witness in this day how most of the people, because of such love and hate, are bereft of the immortal face, have strayed far from the embodiments of the divine mysteries, and shepherdless are roaming through the wilderness of oblivion and error. Does that remind you of another passage somewhere else in the writings? No remnant of either love or hate. Seven valleys, right? Do you have it there? What does it say in the seven valleys? Something like that, right? If I could remember, I'd say it myself, but I don't remember the quote exactly. It says, yes. Anyway, sanctify yourself from all love or hate, lest you be misguided by either one of them. It's in the first part of the Valley of Search. So you can search for it there. We must... Shoghi Effendi writes on this, please. How about that? We'll have an open forum. I'm sure everybody can contribute to that. Okay, how about the love of a spouse that gets so intense, and we say, well, this is legitimate, it's inside marriage, and I'm just devoted to my spouse. You know, I just love my wife more than anything in the world. So, and Abdul Baha said about this, if two people, one of them loves the other more than they love God, it will be the cause of holding back both of them. This is a delicate matter, you know? In other words, our priorities have to be right. First is the love of God, and then the rightful love and affection of a spouse and of all the other friends. But it should derive from the love of God. It's legitimate. Everything becomes legitimate by the love of God. For instance, seeking knowledge and science and understanding should be motivated by the love of God. If it's motivated by something else, Abdu'l-Bahá says it leads by degrees to madness. Madness in the sense of lack of equilibrium, you know? Because one becomes proud of their polish and accomplishment in some sphere of life and then begins to assume errors about what their position should be and how they should be viewed by others. After all, they've invested so much in their education and in their learning and they have made solid contributions. But if it acts as a veil, that's a kind of a madness. It takes you away from God. Love, if you will, of other people, I think, in the first instance, is what we're talking about here, as is hate. Hating people, jealous of people that are doing something that we would like to do but we can't do, and that jealousy and hate and envy is the cause of our own stagnation. We don't go forward because of it. Love of things, love of possessions, which keeps us from arising to serve the cause of God, because I don't want to go to a country where I can't have a refrigerator or some. Or how will I use my VCR if there's no electricity? And some of these things are echoing in modern terms. The Guardian's words, he said, they don't go pioneering because they don't want to leave behind their refrigerator. And this is pathetic, but it's like that, you know. We're attached to our things. We use every excuse. We have a great love for our children. We love our children more than the cause. We don't want to sacrifice our children for the cause. So we say to ourselves, we have to stay here to so our children can study in schools where the majority of children have taken drugs before 11 years old. But we're not going to a foreign country because who knows what kind of poor education they would receive there. You know, it's a strange kind of protectionism that we have in certain instances. Now, that may be an extreme expression of this subject, but we do tend to get in traps like that. There are legitimate reasons why we have to remain sometimes for illness of loved ones and all other things. But all in all, usually it's our attachment to things which tends to create the other barriers that we see in our way from doing things we want to do for the cause. You know, I'm sure all of you had reasons you couldn't come to the World Center. Somehow you overcame them and you came, you know. If you'd used the logic of the world, you wouldn't be here, wasting a year of your lives or more without any income, voluntary service on some mountain in the Middle East, or surrounded by dangers on all sides of imminent war and disaster, and environmentally one of the most polluted cities in the world. But I don't know, why are we here, you know? It's fun, yeah. Okay. Now, someone asked Shoghi Effendi about this passage about no remnant of either love or hate, and they thought, how can a person live without any love or hate? What do we hate? Maybe we think, how can we live without love when we're told in the writings that we must love and we must be the essence of love? He says through his secretary, we must never take one sentence in the teachings and isolate it from the rest. It does not mean we must not love, but we must reach a spiritual plane where God comes first and great human passions are unable to turn us away from Him. All the time we see people who either through the force of hate or the passionate attachment they have to another person sacrifice or bar themselves from the path of God. We must love God, and in this state a general love for all men becomes possible. We cannot love each human being for himself, but our feeling towards humanity should be motivated by our love for the Father who created all men. This is in Unfolding Destiny, page 457. This letter side, please.
This perhaps it will ask the example of love can be given as the martyrs where the time of this excuse that we find the family member. And they will say, we challenge you whether you will cut up or destroy your wife or your child. And they would be, and they will push themselves from that problem.
Yeah. I mean, that's the ultimate test. But that, of course, is freedom from love. I mean, that kind of detachment and being protected by God in such a moment to be able to do the right thing and realize the evanescence of the world. It's highly challenging. Any other comments on that? We've reached the end of our time this evening. We'll come back and savor some more of these passages, please, David.
Is the passage on 192 just before that two secrets part that talks about the ten that have the inscription?
Yes. Now, where are you finding this? On 191, you say?
2 lines before the two secret passage.
Oh. Ask ye therefore. Okay, this is again Quran 16:43. I don't have any note on that in particular. Custody of the scriptures. I don't know whether it's some special group of people, or just means those who have a book from God and can cite from it. You read it in the passage, inasmuch as it hath been clearly shown that only those who are initiated again into the divine mysteries can comprehend the melodies uttered by the bird of heaven. It's therefore incumbent upon everyone to seek enlightenment from the illumined in heart and from the treasuries of divine mysteries regarding the intricacies of God's faith and the abstruse allusions in the utterances of the day springs of holiness. Thus will these mysteries be unraveled, not by the aid of acquired learning, but solely through the assistance of God and the outpourings of His grace. Ask ye therefore of them that have the custody of the scriptures, if ye know it not. I don't know why he's capped it with that particular phrase, except that must have some implication of people who are again initiated and have knowledge of the scriptures and could elucidate it, if not interpret it. Any other points tonight? Please.
Regarding that, I think we must have a knowledge in the fact one would have to come from the from love and get all the topics. So I think probably when you go up next, one would have to have a personal comment. Am I right?
Yes, I think what you're saying is really not that we should move away from this standard, but that, as Shoghi Effendi says, don't take one sentence in isolation from the rest. In other words, we also have duties prescribed to us to take care of our families and to take care of our loved ones and to provide education for our children and protect the community and to look after the welfare of all those around us. It's not a detachment that just is disinterested in anything around it. Quite to the contrary, we should be detached in the sense of not be attached to the things we do and deriving all our joy just from that which we are doing, but to derive our joy from God giving us strength to be more actively involved with everyone else around us, to be concerned, to make them know that we're concerned, to not be distant and remote, detached in that sense. But the question is, the motivation should be right. We're not attached to people so that we can seduce their friendship, if you will, so that we can have them for our own, being nice to people so that for our sakes, so that they will be nice to us. The favors that we do to people so that they'll be in our favor, so to speak. So much of this trade-off goes on in modern life. But to be the expression of a love which, as he mentioned there, shines out of the heart because of its connections with God. But in the sense you're saying, to be balanced, really we should be more involved but not attached in that sense. No. It should be so. If we don't get credit for something we're doing, it doesn't matter to us. We're doing it for the sake of God. And that's why we should study, and that's why we should treat our families right, and so many other things. We sometimes think we should do it because that's proper and good. But all these things should derive from the Word of God and the laws of God. That gives us the proper balance, if you will. Moderation is not halfway between what God says to do and what the world says to do. You know, that puts us in a middle zone, that we're not either with the world and enjoying it, and on the other hand, we're not with the teachings of the faith and enjoying the good pleasure of God. We should do that. Don't do more than Baha'u'llah says. But that's the standard of moderation. You know? And he does enjoin on us all these other duties and responsibilities in life. I think that would be true too. Again, the view of truth or of inspiration that flows in the soul is warped and distorted by loves, hates, dislikes, prejudices, passions. All these things tend to muddle our vision, or at least give it curves. And you know how if you look through these mirrors at the fun houses, it creates a great distortion. You know, you think you're seeing something, suddenly your stomach is huge or your nose has gotten out of size. Well, that's the way we view things if our vision is distorted, if it's not clear, you know. So we see something on the street that attracts us very much. But that isn't the way it looks. That's only the way it looks because of the way we look at it. You know, we see it out of size, and it's somebody else would look at it and say, the poor fool. Well, enjoy your week again.